Good morning. Is it on? Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to welcome you all here to the Nelson Mandela Theatre to really discuss a provocative question: social good and market returns, question mark. So I'd like to just start with a couple housekeeping items, and then we will go into this absolutely fascinating session. First of all, if I could ask you all to please turn off your mobile phones. The session is being recorded, and I understand mobile phones interfere with the mics. We will come back to the Q&A, so I will just give you briefly the format of this session. It's going to be slightly different. We have no technology here other than the mics, so this is all about human capital here this morning. And we're going to, I will introduce the panel shortly after we have had an opportunity to interact. So each of the panelists will speak for about 5 minutes. I will ask you for quick, sharp feedback after each of the panelists has spoken. So if something that the panelist has said resonates with you, quick, sharp feedback. So this is not Q&A. This is just quick, sharp feedback. And then we will have a couple questions that the panel is going to discuss. And then we will open it up for Q&A. We are very, very aware with this illustrious audience. We have a fantastic panel here, but we also have an absolutely illustrious audience where many of you could be part of this panel. So we'd like to spend most of the time actually with Q&A to get feedback, to exchange and learn from each other. So when we get to the Q&A, we will aim to get there about a quarter to 12. At the conclusion of the session, we would like to ask you to vacate this theater promptly. Now, given that this is followed by lunch, that's probably not that difficult to do, but lunch will be served in the entrance hall, and I am informed that seminar rooms A and B are particularly conducive to networking. So please feel free to go. And if you are sitting at the end of a row, if you could move toward the middle, and sorry to inconvenience you, but if you could move toward the middle, that would be very, very much appreciated, because people tend to hover at the edges. So we will have a full session here this morning. And without further ado, I would just like to get a sense of who we have in the audience. Given the topic, we just wanted to see how many of you are actually funders or investors. Could you raise your hands? Okay, quite a few. How many of you think you can have your cake and eat it too? Ooh! All right. So I'd like to see what this looks like at the end of the session, because really that's what we are talking about this morning: quantifiable social benefits, quantifiable environmental benefits, but also market returns. We have an illustrious panel to address these questions, and I will introduce each one of them very briefly. Their bios are in your materials. David Chen focuses on sustainability. He set up Equilibrium Capital Group, the most focused integrated and market-leading investment firm in sustainability. David, that is a tall order. So
somehow I think that got rewritten.
I'm comfortable with the most, are you? Okay, all right. Well, there is modesty here as well. So David Chen. Next to David is John McCormack Bain, a very interesting entrepreneur in his own right, a founder of his own charity with his wife, Marcy. Connection with Oxford, Rhodes Scholar here at Oxford, so this is homecoming in a way. So John McBain. And then next to John is Nico Donahue, head of global research at J.P. Morgan, one of the firms that I worked in as well. He also sponsors the firm's social finance group. So a very diverse panel here from an investor perspective, a GP perspective, and a foundation perspective as well. So David, if you would be so kind and start us with the particular emphasis on your view on impact investing, whether investors need to sacrifice return to achieve social good, and what is it specifically that you are doing in this space?
Great, thank you. Well, first of all, I have to apologize. I don't know quite how that intro took place. Quite the contrary, we're a very small and a very young company. I spent the vast majority of my career, the last 30 years, in the high-tech industry, and then the last 10 years as a general partner in a venture fund. And 2.5 years ago, some would call it crazy, embarked on trying to, in many ways, conduct a bold experiment, which is to try to find out and try to define a set of ways that, in fact, you could have, to use the phrase that we started off with, your cake and eat it too. A little bit of perspective. What Equilibrium Capital Group is focused on is investing and building asset management companies in key areas of sustainability. It's a really, really very, very defined niche, very small niche. And it's basically built on our premise that when you look at sustainability issues, we found that it was very rare that it was lack of technology or lack of products. It almost always boiled down to that you couldn't see scalable, sustainable impact because you couldn't find the mechanisms to change behavior, and you couldn't find the right way to route market-based capital in sufficient quantities to address the issues. And when we looked at the capital issue, we started to really understand that at the heart of it was not real. When you could see scalability taking place and when you could see capital being applied into one of these sectors, it was when you properly aligned the incentives, properly aligned the benefits, and found the investors and aligned their specific needs to that. Now, that all sounds very conceptual, and I'll give you two examples of that. We all forget that the 30-year fully amortized home mortgage is actually an artifact of social and public policy. It was an artifact of government wanting more home ownership. Prior to that period of time, and this is 80, 90 years ago, the idea of a loan being fully amortized over a 30-year period, that's a financial innovation. More recently, and by the way, it goes without saying, aside from the last 2 years of the subprime, this has been a very robust financial services market. It's been supported by an entire ecosystem. Capital has streamed in multiple formats into the home mortgage marketplace. It's a robust, liquid marketplace. It's a transparent marketplace, again, other than what's happened in the last few years. A more recent example of applying incentives, and this may get a little esoteric for some of the folks in the room, but in the wind energy area, in late 90s, early 2000s, a structure known as the tax equity flip structure, the tax equity market appeared. And up until then, I would submit to you that between 1999 and the year 2002 and 2003, no difference in windmill technology. Frankly, if you take the United States, there was no difference in the governmental incentive programs. What was created was a mechanism whereupon those that had the benefits could accrue those benefits, and that structure, the tax equity flip structure, was a financial innovation and a financial instrument that ultimately unlocked the capital markets. It was something that Wall Street knew how to sell, and it was something that investors knew how to buy, and it was something that lawyers knew how to paper a contract around. And so it was these set of examples that fascinated us, and we started to take a look at what sustainability factors, sustainability marketplaces, where if we could apply that kind of innovation, financial innovation, I realize that in these days and age, that's a bit of a dirty word, but where we could apply financial innovation to that. We think the markets of green building, the built environment, of energy, water, carbon, and food, and of natural resource and land sustainability are markets that are all ripe for this kind of innovation to take place. We think if you can solve this problem, you have tremendous impact on both environmental as well as societal and social impact, as well as, because these are huge, robust marketplaces, you absolutely have the opportunity to create market rates of return on this. But the innovation is in how to create the proper structuring. For me, at the heart of this, if you, and maybe this sounds a little too academic and theoretical, but at the heart of this is looking forward over the course of the next few decades. And if I use investor speak, it's not about, one of the ways to describe it has been, quote unquote, the pricing in of externalities. If I were to look at this from an investor standpoint, I think this is the most basic of basics. And that is that what we're trying to do is to find, as we go into the next few decades, what are the sources of value creation that align with these trends of environment and societal? So the new forms of value creation, what constitutes a more valuable asset as we go into the future? The second one is the risk side, and that is that as we see environmental degradation and societal issues, how are these then the risks that make an asset into the future less valuable or put the value of that asset at risk? And so I think that in many ways, the issue of whether you can have your cake and eat it too boils down to, are you a smart investor that's looking out into the future and asking where the future sources of value and the future sources of risk and the degradation of your value really are there? And so I think I'll stop there without giving the next example.
David, you raised a number of very interesting points, one being that the markets are there provided that the infrastructure and the innovations are there. And you mentioned wind, you mentioned a number of examples in the clean energy space. I would just like to get a couple quick reactions from the audience. Do you think the market is there, particularly in renewable energy, to really make investments that really have impact? And by impact, we mean generate market returns, but also have a social and environmental impact. Where are the stewards, please? Just a couple. Any quick reactions, please? Yes, please.
Olivier Deguer from Features. Just a question on market return. What do you expect? 5%, 10%, double digit? Do you really think that today we can have double digit returns and social return?
Okay, the question is what do we mean by market return? Okay, fine. Yes, over here, please. Just there, thank you.
I think until the pricing of externalities has been properly completed, and I don't know how that's done, you will find it very difficult to have a level playing field.
Okay.
I think that's one of the most interesting questions that arises.
Okay. So let's focus on. Okay. This row has the monopoly. This is wonderful. Go ahead.
Third comment. From Inspire. I think the key question is what you get into. Can we transfer this, for us, interesting investment in wind and so on into something with the general public can understand easily? So this transfer, I'm very interested to see how you can do that. And that's not only for wind, but for similar issues.
Let me just clarify, make sure we understand the point being, for renewable energy or clean energy, can we create it in a way that the public understand it?
So simple that a normal banker can sell it to a normal customer.
Normal banker to normal customer, that's quite an assumption. Okay, terrific. Terrific. Thank you so much for all three comments. What do you mean by market return, externalities, the importance of externalities? Can we really create the structures that normal people can understand? Fantastic. John, over to you, please.
Thank you. I'm not actually an investor. I'm more an owner, which I think is a little different. I'm more an owner and entrepreneur. So I have to couch my comments in that light. But my wife, Marcy, is here as well. And I setting up a foundation and trying to separate sort of what I call the church and state dilemma, which is the church being the donation side and the state being the investment side or the ownership side. And we try to sort of cross over a bit. And I guess just go right to the question, whether investors need to sacrifice return or whether owners need to sacrifice return. I think that I sort of give three answers to that in sort of perspectives. One is that we've found, and although that's our theory, we're still in the middle of the experiment, so I'll tell you in a few months whether it's true, but our view would be that we can make an equal return on two conditions. Number one is that we take more risk, so maybe the risk-adjusted return may be lower, but we also work a lot harder on it, which has a feedback effect, probably reduces our risk. So I think that if you're willing to work harder and take a little more risk, you shouldn't sacrifice returns. And that's sort of our theory. And we're trying to prove that, and hopefully we are. Also,
John, sorry for budging in here. Maybe picking up the comment or the question of what do we mean by market returns?
I was going to jump on my third point was actually that is I think that market returns should be looked at in a realistic perspective. If you're taking a large foundation, you're taking lower inflation right now, at least right now, you're taking I think expected lower returns in the stock market. I'd say that return is in the for a foundation on average would be in the 7-10% range. I think that a foundation long term planning to do, you know, over 10% returns every year is probably, you know, they're going to have a down year. And secondly, I think that if we take those numbers on at least on an ownership private basis, are not that hard to meet. I think we can meet them on a social return. So I'm looking at that number. I think that if you're looking at 20-25% returns, maybe not, but maybe they not won't be sustainable as well. So that was actually my third point. But that's the number we're sort of targeting. So back to the first one. I think that and secondly, you know what. Role to a social enterprise, and we do them, and I'll give you some examples. You know, is the social aspect the goal and the economics of the goal, in other words, the way you price things as well as what you're delivering, or can you deliver something which has a social purpose and price it the way you think it should be priced to make your return and then take your profits and actually reinvest them as subsidies internally to your own project? So in other words, if you were scanning for breast cancer in a hospital in the developing world, would you, you know, do it for everyone for $50 in a social enterprise, or would you price everyone $100 and then subsidize 25 people for free? So that's sort of I think they're both social enterprises. In our case, what we do in our business is we will try to have it as a business, so we can bring in partners, owners, operators, managers who can get equity and take downside, not just options in equity, so they can make a return. And sometimes we will adjust those returns if we do something directly in the business, but most times we will just take 80% or 90%, whatever our ownership position is, and reinvest it in either the country or the project as a donation. So that's the first thing, the risk and work. The second aspect is how we came upon this. And we came upon this by saying, gee, you know, what should we invest in? And there's, you know, obviously the first thing is don't invest in bad things. I think a lot of us have got that. The second thing we said is, let's look at the functional areas we're working on in our foundation. So we have three, you know, general functional areas. One is education, health, and the environment. So we said, let's look first at investments where we can hit one of those three areas. It may not be investments that have any social purpose, any purpose beyond that, but at least we're learning something of that sector, and hence we can use that learning in our foundation. And the secondary effect, which I'll give you an example of, we also learned that by investing in a sector which may not be a social investment, it leads us to a social investment as well as leading us to more knowledge in our own donation sector. So the example is actually one from this town. I have several children, and my children were taking the International Baccalaureate revision courses from a company called the Oxford Study Courses, which is the leading reviser of this area. And so we thought this is a great business. I met the lady that owns it and actually bought that company. And now the foundation is the largest reviser for the National Baccalaureate, which is a profit-making enterprise. The profits go to the foundation. We'll be giving them away. We're going to give them away actually to educational purposes. So in that way, it's a social enterprise. But what's interesting is that brought us closer to the International Baccalaureate. So we learned about education, et cetera, but we also started thinking a lot about online education. And so that led us to meet the people at the International Baccalaureate Organization in Geneva. And 4 weeks ago, we signed a deal with them to put all their courses online in a 7-year deal. So it's a social enterprise. We're putting about 20 million euros into that deal. My two managers, each of them are putting in 1 million euros. So we've got downside. We've got good protection on that. And so what we've got is we got a system where we started by a theory that, we can help the foundation by learning about education. But it also helped us learn about other social business we can do in that area. And hence, we've got this deal with the International Baccalaureate, which I think is hopefully going to increase access. They had an access agenda. We hooked onto that agenda, said, we can increase access by not having to use bricks and mortar and how we do that. So that's one example. Our second business example is we started the other way. We started from the foundation side. We said, we'd like to do work on maternal mortality issues in Liberia, which is the country we focus on. And my wife looked at the hospital budgets in some of the counties, in Bong County and a few others, and saw that, half the hospital budget is basically repairing the diesel generators, buying diesel generators, transporting fuel, buying diesel fuel. And we said, this isn't very good because we're, all we're doing is basically subsidizing subsidizing CO2 emissions by a good project. So we got some good and some bad. So in that one, we said, what we really need is to get power to those hospitals and clinics, because then if we can get power at half the price, we've basically given a donation of 25% of the budget for every hospital within our distribution area. So what happened there is we said, that's interesting. So we looked around and we found out that a gentleman in the power area said, there's two great correlations, and we knew one of the great correlation development, which is women's education and GDP per capita. But the other great correlation is kilowatt hours per person and GMP per capita. So if you look at countries, if you have very few kilowatt hours per person available, electricity, you have a fairly low GMP per capita. That's a fairly strong correlation. So we said, not only will it help the hospital sector, we could help the country. So what we did is we found a Canadian company, actually, which was chipping end-of-life rubber trees and using them to export and to Europe to replace coal, and hence for they're carbon neutral because we're replanting the trees. So it's replacing CO2, basically taking CO2 out of the air in Europe, but you had to ship it to Europe. So we bought that company, changed it, and we also do the shipping to Europe part as a biomass strategy to help CO2. But at the same time, we're taking those chips and building a power plant in Liberia to develop power for them. So what does that do? Well, it hopefully will make a return for the foundation. Secondly, it's an indirect donation to all the hospitals, et cetera, in that area, as well as schools. And thirdly, it's creating a lot of employment by chipping the trees. And lastly, what's interesting, the second order effect was it was also increasing the arable useful plantation land, and hence increasing rural employment for 25-year jobs. Because each time you replace the rubber tree, it has a 25-year life cycle. So there's one where we said, what is our financial return? So my third point is when you look at your return, you say, and somebody says, do you have your cake and eat it too? It depends if you like cake. So the reason I say that is as follows, is because if you are an investor who has pure personal reasons for investing, then your total return may be only your financial return. If you're actually a cake maker and somebody walks in and says, I'll pay you, instead of paying you $5 for a cake, I'll pay you $4, and I'll give you $2 worth of wholesale price flour, you might take that deal and actually get a better return than him paying $5. Okay? So in the same way, our foundation says, here's what we're doing. We want to go around and make a donation to hospitals, which we could afford to give them 20% of their budget, let's say. But gee whiz, by doing this other thing, we're giving them 25% of their budget as well. So basically, we've made a donation of 45% as opposed to 20%. So I think that, if you're cake and eat it too, and you have to like cake. So in other words, the foundations like cake. So if you're going to take some money from somewhere and put it into reducing CO2 or whatever, then if the business itself can do that, you've actually got a double return. And my example in that is in sort of where this social enterprise can work is I'm chairman of the European Climate Foundation, which I started with the Hewlett Foundation and their work with the Energy Foundation in the United States in Europe. And there we see one of our big things is stopping new coal plants. And that is a classic advocacy and a classic donation where you make the donation, they do that, they protest, whatever, and eventually, hopefully, coal plants will be stopped. But the problem is, there's a second thing. There's already coal plants existing, believe it or not, and they're still working every day, and it's very difficult through advocacy to convince these companies to stop that plant because they've got a 40-year investment. So there's a social enterprise come in. So with Buchanan Renewables, we're able to get fairly dry, in terms of very dry hardwood, and substitute that for coal. So our social enterprise, yes, will hopefully make some money, but at the same time, it is giving a donation to reduce coal. And we're the, so basically there's no long-term supply chains for biomass, so we're sort of being the one going out there, the catalyst entrepreneur, going out to the power plants that companies say, look, you're very concerned. We've taken on all the risk. We've gone to Liberia. We spent $100 million on this project. It works. We're credible. Come in and invest in that. But by doing that, of course, we're reducing CO2 in their existing plants, starting with 10, 20%, eventually pelletizing, torrefaction, to actually reduce to 50, 60% of their coal production. So that's an example where I think social enterprise is better at reducing existing coal plants' output by creating long-term biomass change, as opposed to a donation through a European Climate Foundation, which I'd recommend, which will reduce creating new plants. So that's sort of where I see we are. Thank you.
Fantastic. So anybody who likes cake, would you like to make a short, sharp comment at this point? Yes, over here, please. Thank you.
The comment I'd like to make is I'd love to sort of focus in a little bit on what is social, because it's very easy to extrapolate 2-3 generations down the line that some of these technologies are ultimately increasing people's lives, but how broad do we want to make that definition without diluting what we really mean?
Okay, good question. What is social? Any other comment?
Hello, I just wanted to add, thank you so much for your contributions already. On John's comments on risk and return and liking cake, I work for a UK-based organisation that's an early investor in risk capital for social enterprises. And what's cake for us is actually not so much the returns that we make on our investments, but the way in which we can unlock further capital invested into the vehicles we're early adopters of. And so for us, that's the cake. And I think what we've observed over the last 2 to 3 years of the social investment space in the UK in the new markets is that we've seen a variety of different forms of capital with different types of appetite. And the important thing is to match the propositions with the appetite of the investments, whether it be about financial or social returns and the type of things they're interested in.
Fantastic. Thank you. David, you wanted to... Yeah, just one more comment here, the lady in the turquoise.
Hi, Christine Ibsinger from Ian Co. And it's quite interesting to hear about the integration that you've done between the foundation side and the investment side. And it would be a terrific contribution if there was significant integration along the finance continuum. But unfortunately, it's not really the world that we're living in. So I would just like to ask, when we're working with foundations or with the more philanthropic or concessional community, how do we package the types of investments you were talking about, John, so that we engage that investment capital, that we're able to basically package the types of benefits that you articulated and be able to attract capital that, at least from a governance viewpoint, isn't as intricately connected as your foundation and your investment company are?
Christine, thank you. Thank you so much for that. David, you wanted to make a quick comment, and John, would you like to respond to
go ahead, David, sure.
Yeah, the quick comment was if you John's comments were tremendous, but if you take apart what he talked about in all of his examples, there's a theme that is very much along the theme of almost everything he's doing is about, and this is where the externality issues come in. Almost everything of what he's talking about is mapping out, and I hate to use these words, but the ecosystem and trying to figure out where the value or where the extra margin or where the inefficiencies were or where the new social or environmental change should be, and then capturing that value. And this issue is going to be just so central to it, because if we really believe that things are changing, then we're talking about remapping how the value flow, the funds flow, the cash flow, and then figuring out how to take that and deploy upon that. In some ways, that's giving with one hand or taking with the one hand or putting one value into another value bucket. But that's the hard work aspect of it, because you can't have, quote unquote, a paradigm change without rethinking what the entire flow is.
Quickly, I know Nick wants to speak, but to respond quickly to your question, I think that, so if you're going to this foundation or other organization, I think it's, take the example of coal. So you go to I'm making this up, the Hewlett Foundation, and you say, look, Hewlett Foundation, you're very concerned about climate change. We understand you got great grants and advocacy, and they're doing X, Y, Z, but here I've got a social enterprise product which actually does two things. It does part of your, like the existing coal plant reduction in CO2. This project will reduce the CO2 in that way, which you aren't covering and can't cover with donations, or is much better covered by this. And by the way, one of the big advantages, I think, of these social enterprises, and one of the reasons it has to make some return, is that it's sustainable. So even the best grants, every foundation is worried with being sustainable. I think one of the easy hoops you jump over in social enterprise, if you can show return as well, is that, gee, we're more sustainable. So I think that there is an open ear. The problem is, who do you go to? Because there's laws, as you know, which we sort of are able to play with because we can play both sides of the fence, that say, you know, foundations can invest in profitable enterprise. So you have to get over that technical thing. And I think that David's point is, you know, we need to change a bit the paradigm and how we deal with that. Because, you know, the local, to go back to my cake example, the local boulanger, the guy that's making the cakes, he'd love to take that deal, $4 and $2 worth of wholesale price flour as opposed to $5 cash. But if he's in a big enterprise, they won't allow him. They say, no, you got to collect $5 cash. So it's the same in the way we act institutionally with our rules on foundations versus investments. But a foundation should be able to say, gee, here's our return. It's that plus the fact of substituted donation, which you actually think is better.
Sorry. Thank you so much. Nick, over to you, please.
Thanks, Herta. Thank you for the invitation. It's a great privilege and pleasure to be here. I wear a couple of hats at J.P. Morgan. As Herta said in her introduction, I'm the global head of research, so I'm responsible for all our various research analysts and economists around the world. And that's my day job. My more interesting job is that I am responsible for a group that we set up about two and a half years ago in the bank called Social Finance. And Social Finance has a number of different objectives. We invest in social enterprises. We effectively use the financial capital, or try to employ some of the financial capital at J.P. Morgan to support double bottom line enterprises. We try to mobilize the human capital at the firm to help with structuring and distribution and placement of social investments or impact investments. We're involved in research in a number of areas around this subject, and then we try also to work with our philanthropy dollars to try and promote the development of a sort of an ecosystem or an investing infrastructure around impact investing. So we're a lead sponsor, for example, for the Global Impact Investing Network. So that's what we do. So let me try to, and I guess I'm sort of wearing both my research and my social finance hat here when I try to answer the question of whether or not there really is a free lunch here. And I want to come back to David mentioned the word externalities, and this questioner in the audience also mentioned externalities, and that is really the way that I think about this issue. Every time we make an investment, we are creating impact and we are creating externalities, and that's always been true. And when I say investment, I mean allocating new capital. So I'm distinct. So that is not buying and selling on the stock exchange, where you're effectively creating new capital for the enterprise, just simply changing the ownership of the enterprise. But where I'm defining investment is actually investing new capital in either debt or equity. Every time you do that, now and at any point in history, you've created some form of externality. And those externalities can be positive, so creation of jobs, for example, or they can be negative. They can create emissions or environmental damage and so on. And again, that's always been the case. I think what's different about this field of impact investing is, for the first time, the investment community is trying to define and to measure the social impact of what they're doing. So they're trying to measure this externality that's being created. And they're obviously trying to emphasize and invest in those, take advantage of those investment opportunities that create positive externalities. And if you're one of the people in the audience who put up your hand at the beginning and said you thought there was, in answer to Herta's question, you said you thought there's a free lunch. I think effectively what you're saying is you think that externality is effectively free. And I think if you're saying that, you either are somewhat misguided, okay, and I think you're, because either you are underestimating the required risk return of the required risk-adjusted return of the investment you're making. I see that a lot. I mean, I'll use the example of microfinance, for example. people walk into us with the idea of investing, say, in microfinance funds. And I think microfinance really has been sort of the flagship so far of impact investing. And they say to us that their target IRR for this fund is 15 to 20%. And if I'm going, as a rational, risk-adjusted investor, if I'm going to invest in a fund that is, as most microfinance funds are, they're startups, they're greenfield sites, they're in some of the most, they're investing the money in some of the most emerging of the emerging markets around the world. If I'm going to rationally approach that investment, 15 to 20% is not a reasonable risk-adjusted return. That's you would benchmark that investment against startup, venture capital type investments where typically the targeted IRRs are 30, 35, 40%. So there is clearly, if you make the decision to invest, in my view, in a microfinance fund with a 20% target IRR, you're making a social trade-off. You may not recognize it, but you're making it. And that gets to that point the questioner asked earlier about what's the right return. I don't think there is any one right return. You need to think about what the risk of the investment you're making and what the appropriate risk-adjusted return for that investment is. So I think you may, if you think there's a free lunch, you may be underestimating the required risk return of the investment you're making. I think the second possibility, and I see this regularly too, is that people confuse one possible outcome with the average outcome. And one of the things about this field of impact investing is we have no data, or we have almost no data. So it's very difficult to rationally answer, to prove one way or the other whether this free lunch exists. But if we think in a theoretical sense, if you make thousands of investments of equal risk and equal social impact, you are going to get a range of outcomes. And some of those outcomes are going to be superior to normal commercial returns. So again, if you use a microfinance example, Compar Thomas, which many of you in the audience will be familiar with, was clearly a very commercial return for the people that initially invested capital. But I don't think you should confuse one outcome or extrapolate one outcome to assume that that's going to be the average outcome of every social, every impact investment you make. So I think those are two. So if you're making the free lunch case, I think, as I said, you may be slightly misguided or perhaps just a little over-optimistic. I think there are also more rational reasons why you might be seen to be having a free lunch. One of them is many of these impact investments have been structured in tranches so that the commercial investors are getting what is effectively a commercial return. The reason they're getting that is because there are other investors more junior in the capital structure that are actually getting a less than commercial return, so they're effectively subsidizing the commercial people. I actually think that's a big part of the future of this whole field, is to try and find ways of bringing these often foundations and DFIs together with commercial investments and structuring investments that can effectively keep both sides happy. But again, I don't think that's the same as saying it's a free lunch. I mean, the fact is you're getting a subsidy, and that subsidy is coming, let's say, typically from a foundation or DFIs. And then I think sometimes there is a case to be made that the social outcome that you're creating can effectively be monetized. And I think that's a more difficult case to make. But the idea that by investing certain bottom of the pyramid investments allows you to create scale, which allows you to build a business that in turn produces commercial returns. I've heard that case made, and I think that's a reasonable. There are certainly areas where are opportunities. I think that's rare, but I think it's still possible. So I guess where I come out in the question of is there a free lunch, I'd have to say I don't honestly believe so. I think there, except in very rare circumstances, and I think there is a danger in this field in overselling. And I think we're seeing some, again, that I come back to microfinance because that's where we have the most data and the most evidence. But I think you see real examples in the microfinance world of overselling. And overselling, particularly in a credit business, as we've seen in even in the most developed markets over the last 2 or 3 years, can be very dangerous, leads to over-indebtedness, leads to multiple borrowing, and so on. So I think we have to be very careful how we position this social financial trade-off. And I'm certainly in the camp that says if you aspire to create a positive externality, you're going to have to pay for it.
Nick, thank you so much. Now, I don't know if the audience would agree that you are a normal banker, but certainly it's you have put a couple of very, very challenging things into the room. I said we would start with Q&A a quarter to 12, and I think that's where we are. So let's do that. We have a number of questions that we certainly want to make sure that they get aired, but let's open the floor and I'll interject the questions if need be, if they have not already been asked. So with the formal Q&A, this is an audience that is very passionate, and we are all here because we want to achieve something and we want to make a difference, and that means we have a lot to say. So, but can I just ask that we will try and get as many comments in as absolutely possible and as many questions. So just a little bit of housekeeping here. Would you kindly identify yourself? Would you make your question or comment as brief as possible? And then make sure that whatever you say ends up with a question mark. Can we do that? So please, over here, first question, please, at the aisle.
Jason Saw with Kellogg Business School at Northwestern. My question is, it seems, first a statement, then a question. It seems that we may be conflating two things. One is this sort of joint hybrid return of a social and an economic return, and the other is the case for a pure economic commercial return by using social change as the means to produce that return. And what I'm interested in is, have you seen any cases where we can produce a competitive, if not even more compelling, economic return by social arbitrage or finding social opportunities that are not commercially exploited that happen to also do good, but are primarily not a social purpose investment, but an economic purpose investment?
Is that directed to the panel as a whole?
Yes.
Nick, would you like to take that question?
Well, yeah,
first?
I mean, I think there are certainly cases where, if I understand your question correctly, where social issues create the opportunity for commercial investment. I'm not convinced that that's the purpose of impact investing. You know, I think some of the clean tech investments, for example, have got a big issue. You've got effectively a major profit opportunity at the same time as you have a major social issue. I think you would hope that the market, it's the normal commercial investment market, would work pretty well to bring those, to solve some of those problems. Perhaps impact investing at the very beginning can catalyze some of those investments and has a role to play. But I think over time, you know, those opportunities exist, but I think that a functioning market should be able to take to address those issues.
John, any would you like to add?
This time I'll agree with Nick on that. I think that there are lots of good examples to match your thing, and we can think of probably hundreds. But probably over time, on average, there will be equal or lower return. I think on that. I don't think that on average, you know, we of course all work very hard not to be average. So maybe that's not the answer for us, but for everybody else, the average of course never includes anybody in the room. But so.
Okay, David, I know your views are a bit different on that.
The reason I think it was a tough. First of all, you know, I think that one of the investments we've made is. Let me step back. One of the things that if anyone was in the session that was in this room this morning, one of the observations that I made is that, and we see this all the time, one of the things that John talks about is the fact that by investing or delving into social and environmental issues, you oftentimes get commercial ideas. Sometimes in the commercial ideas in these kind of spaces, you get opportunities for NGO and not-for-profit and high-impact work. And I think this duality is something that, in fact, I would argue is going to be a core competency of the investor going forward, mm-hmm. living in these two worlds and comfortably living in these two worlds. And so our way of doing it in our firm is that we spend a lot of our time both on active investment in our portfolio, but also in I don't know any other way of putting this, pro bono work, working with organizations that we find have very nascent business models. And so one of the observations I was going to make is that if you sat in on the session this morning, all three of those entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, were not-for-profits, yet they were developing ideas that potentially could have very scalable commercial applications, that if you can retain their mission, their ethos, you actually have a very interesting business. And so one of our companies that we invested in is called Biological Capital. And Biological Capital, for all practical purposes, or the easiest way to describe it, is the for-profit version of the Nature Conservancy. And what it's trying to do is to solve a very significant problem, and that is that aside from very small, potentially a very small set of examples, it's very difficult to actually preserve large tracts of land. You have to have a rule of law. You have to have a certain economic setting in order to preserve. I mean, it's a wealthy concept to preserve a large hunk of land. So in most of the world and most of the applications, you actually have to create an economic vibrancy in the land that allows you to preserve it. And so that means that you have to operate the piece of land as a sustainable land-based business, and especially true in the developing countries. So what's the economic model and the business model to do that? And I won't get into any of the details, but this idea of real estate subsidizing one thing or another, many of you are actually very comfortable with this. We see this example in our cities all the time. Subsidized housing or mixed-use housing, or a developer that develops four downtown blocks and puts a theater on that, in that, because the theater creates a vibrancy in the community. But it's clearly a loss leader. But the way that you justify the theater within that four-block redevelopment is because there's profit coming out of the parking lot, or there's profit coming out of the development of the office building. But to create the value, and this again gets the value definition, the value of that overall project, you have to create the vibrancy and the longevity of that development. And therefore, you'll do things within that development that, quote unquote, are not profitable. And I think those are some of the core concepts that go into these kinds of thinkings about that.
And I think, David, you are touching on the question that was asked earlier, what is social? And if you are looking at the theater as providing a social benefit, then you're coming back full circle that you've got a very profitable arrangement that can, if you will, subsidize the social. I'll come back to you. Excuse me. Can you give her a microphone, please? Because this is all recorded, and we need you to speak in the microphone.
I've seen some entrepreneurs arguing that the parking lot is a social enterprise because it's underwriting the theater.
Right.
But and those types of things. And so that's where you get into this challenge of how far back does the social go?
Mm-hmm. So just a quick point. As a foundation, you know, why should the social issue in the foundation's definition, you can go back to in the UK, the Charitable Purposes Act, and then go from that to what foundations can give to, is that need to be any different than a social enterprise, what her social values should be, the same as the theoretical charitable values in a foundation? You know, there's a debate to be had whether they're different, but I think it's a starting point. You should assume that foundations must give to charitable purposes. Those charitable purposes are defined, and those defined charitable purposes are X, Y, Z, and those should be the same in the social enterprise if they meet those goals as well. But because there's a profit indirectly or directly, our existing structures don't allow that within a foundation. We can't do Buchanan Renewables inside the foundation, do we do it outside? But in the end, the social part of it is the part that is related to a social purpose, which could be the same as in a foundation. Mm,
thank you so much. Mike, question here, please.
Mike Eckhart with the, is this on? Yeah, with the American Council on Renewable Energy. Shifting our attention, most of our attention in social enterprise is on the use of funds, And I want to turn our attention to source of funds. And the private sector investment banking community is very good at structuring private money, senior debt, sub-debt, preferred equity, junior equity, common equity, preferred equity, and all that. Very sophisticated. And we're getting a little bit of that in the social foundation world. But are we really making progress on mixing the social capital with the private capital? You know, the grant money and the PRI money and all of the foundation money that wants to do social good and doesn't even have to be repaid in some cases, with the private capital. And isn't this one of the things going on today, trying to find structures that mix these two sources of capital? And what do you say about that? Are we being successful with that?
Yeah, I think that's an enormously important question, and I think a very timely one. Because, and I made the comment before about the idea that you bring together commercial and social investors. They have different risk trade-offs. They have different return trade-offs. They have different, perhaps, social incentives. But I think being able to bring those two together and mix the capital is very important. We've done work with some of the large foundations in the United States in trying to put together sort of a joint venture company that will try to invest in this particular case, in SME lending and investment in African agriculture. But the idea is that you would have a vehicle that is attractive both to the foundations for their PRI-type money, but also to the commercial investors, and something that you could go around the world to institutions, to private banks, to family offices, to high-net-worth individuals, and there would be a role on that. There would be a place on the capital structure where risk, return, social impact would come together and be attractive to them. But I think it's, you know, this whole area, the challenge for everybody in this emerging industry today and everybody in this room is building this whole investing infrastructure over the next, and it's structuring vehicles that work for more than one investor. It's you know, indices, it's benchmarks, it's all these, and it takes years to sort of create an asset class. But these are the type of questions I think it's important for us to address.
Okay, let's take about three. While John responds, let's take about three questions at a time. And if you could get microphones into the hands of this gentleman and these two gentlemen here, please.
From an ownership point of view, if you look at what we're, you know, if you take Buchanan Enterprises, there's Stan, Jim, and Don. And Stan, Jim, and Don have, you know, they put in money in the business. They've got some stock options. They've got a salary. You know, why did they go there as a social enterprise? And we're going to give away all our profits back to Liberia in the enterprise. And so it's a social, I think it's a clear social enterprise. But how can we mix within the business itself the sort of profit-making ones? Well, A is, you know, unlike institutional investors, these are individuals. So you can also seek and select really good people who have in themselves and their own values a mixed bag of values, not bag of value, but a mixed, they've got a financial return and they've got some social return. They're human beings. And so maybe there is a bias in our sort of entrepreneurial ownership thing. In the owners and managers we attract are people who have a more diverse set of interests than just a pure financial interest, and hence we'll attract them because we can give them a sense of satisfaction, and hence maybe they'll work harder, so hence they'll make up also the financial difference, but at least they'll make a good return because they think we're doing good things, sustainable, etc., on the business side, but on the social side, they think they're doing a good thing as well. So if Stan is 65, he retired from SNC-Lavalin, he wanted to do something, and he's the best in the business, Imperial College graduate in power, but at the same time, he wants to do something good, but at the same time, he hoping to get some financial returns. So the other people are similar. So and I think that by them, also, they're working hard. We think that we can, you can't do it maybe on the average, maybe in sustained investment, but if you're running it as owners, if we can, as a group, you know, if the people can be better at what we're doing then and work harder and be the first ones, the innovators in there, probably we'll have a chance of making higher returns. Over time, yes, on average you'll be there, but you've already got your enterprise then. You've already got your above average returns, so that's okay. So I think that you can, on an individual basis, arbitrage market returns. Now, if we decide at one time that the Buchanan needs to do something special, well, we could put in a preferred share and pay for that extra thing that doesn't affect their return. We can give them a few more stock options if we want to. Or if we run it purely, we can say, okay, no, that's fine. They'll get their return and we get ours, and we can put ours back in to those things through our dividends or whatever. But we can also subsidize it indirectly as a social shareholder to keep and attract good private investors, which is a sort of an indirect way of tranching the investment.
Because, John, you're touching on something which is so different from what we have done historically, because historically we've been thinking in silos.
Right.
We've been thinking profit, shareholder value over here, maximize that value over here, and we've been thinking doing good over here, and never the twain shall meet.
So if the best return your financial investor said was to buy Philip Morris stock, and your foundation only worked on reducing smoking, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you give away. You know, the fact that you're, you know, subscribing maybe to the IPO of a division of distribution division of Philip Morris probably will nullify all the work of your foundation. So, you know, and also it depends where you want to work. So if you spend your time on your foundation making a slightly better grant, is that better than spending more time in the social enterprise to actually make a bigger impact on reducing coal emissions for existing coal plants, for example?
Yes. question.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Marcello Palazzi, Progressive Foundation in the Netherlands. I've been working in this space, blended value, for 20 years, and I just like for a second to have a slightly wider perspective. Many of these sort of social good markets are still, at least in Europe, in the hands of our governments, you know, education, health, the social welfare in general. And I think only now it's beginning to open up and allow the entrepreneurs really to start looking at what are the new innovations. So it is an evolution that has to do with innovation, with entrepreneurship, people who perhaps 10 years ago were busy with their business, now they have time to look at the wider social innovation, you know, dimension. And just as an example, also we talked earlier about renewable energy. You know, there are, to some count, nearly $300 billion of perverse subsidies going to still subsidize, you know, oil industry. So the way our markets, the markets are governed by our governments and other institutions has a huge impact on the potential of entrepreneurs to make a difference. So we should also look at that side of the equation.
Mm, that's very true. Okay. Over here, please.
Hi, I'm Robert Stevenson, and I'm a social entrepreneur out of Dublin, Ireland, and I'm teaching young people how to be social entrepreneurs in four continents through music and multimedia. Now, my question for the panel and for the general audience really is, how do we measure this? Because, you know, I've been involved in this neurotic relationship between, you know, the value for shareholders and the value for society. And I would just like to propose to the forum generally is if we could somehow agree on certain ways of measuring impact and agree that as a standardization in the various areas that we're all working in, that would help the investors, it would help the foundations, and it would help the participants and the practitioners like myself to deliver the best value. So what do you think about that? Okay. And is there a way of measuring that?
Let's take one more question here, please.
Jim Hornthal with CMEA Capital. I was taken by something David said about the 30-year amortizable mortgage as being a public policy that created a financial market. And the point of Nick on subsidies, what we're seeing in the U.S. at least through the DOE loan guarantees is the federal market public policy with Obama putting billions of dollars into a different yield structure where the public policy is enabling companies like A123 to achieve scale and new batteries. And the real question is, what is the role of public policy in creating that hybridization, and where can we as activists impact public policy? Because I think those are where the resources can be moved a small amount but have a huge impact. And is that something you think is part of this tapestry for change, and how do we make that a bigger voice?
Fantastic. So three very good questions in the room. Any one of you who would like to, that particular questions resonated?
Can I address the measurement question? Because I think that's a really, you know, how do you measure social social impact, and you know, from my perspective, that is a measurement system, and from that, a rating system is absolutely fundamental to creating this impact investing as an asset class. If it was easy, it would have been done already. That's the bad news. The good news is that I think there are some very legitimate efforts going on, led by people, the Global Impact Investing Network, the Rockefeller Foundation in the United States, have dedicated substantial funds to trying to put together a coherent system that you know, the principal investors can buy into, that measures that somehow rates social impact. And I think about it in terms, like I think about the credit market. You know, if I want to invest in a bond in credit, I don't go and do a whole lot of credit. I mean, somebody does, but I don't. As a private investor, I don't do a whole lot of credit analysis to figure out whether it's the probability of going bankrupt or whatever. I say it's a AAA, it's a AA. I go to my investment manager and I say, look, I want a portfolio of AA bonds. And I think we need that. It's a difficult thing to do, but if you could imagine a world where there was a recognized agency that all the major participants bought into, that was, you know, would rank something social impact platinum or social impact, and then I think that would be hugely powerful in opening up, particularly the retail chain, to make it easier for investors. You've got to make it easy for retail investors to invest. And you've got to have a level of trust between the investor and the investment manager. And I think, some sort of rating, some measurement is absolutely fundamental to that.
Mm. Thank you so much. John, would you like to pick up the comment and question regarding how do we open up the field, particularly on a continent like Europe, where social entrepreneurship may be to some extent, to the extent that, you know, anything social has happened, it's been in the purview of the government.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that sort of gives an opportunity, too, because a lot of traditional, purely financial investors would look at things and, gee, you know, there's no money made in education or health services, that's the government. Whereas I think more innovative people will say, hey, let's look there first. So you get the first look. So I think that is an interesting thing. And one of the things that sort of bothered me in this conversation is we sort of are going, there's a financial returns, and maybe let me just give you an example where if you look at, let's take baseball teams. If you take baseball teams, why do so many owners want to own baseball teams? And if you did the financial analysis, you'd find that the average baseball team is not a good investment. So why do they buy baseball teams? The reason they buy baseball teams is they feel there's other benefits. So let's take baseball team and substitute social impact. And if you do that, if you feel social impact is more important than baseball, then you could get a good financial return equal to the baseball person's return. So that's from an owner's point of view. Now, why are very few baseball teams owned by J.P. Morgan? Because the baseball guys have convinced them to buy the boxes, right? So they can make a financial return to pay back their loan to J.P. Morgan. No, but more seriously, I think that it's very important. So if all investing was done, quote, professionally, and I would view that potentially the fees take away any difference in return, but that's another issue. So if all returns were done by purely financial investors, we wouldn't have very many baseball teams. And also, if you look around, there's still, although today, tons of travel agents, very few funeral homes. And the reason is that people like the trade, get a few little benefits, whatever. So take those benefits of being a travel agent versus, of course, being a funeral director, and take those of a baseball team and substitute social impact. And I think you might answer the question why owners, when they look at their return, look at the overall return, and the overall return may include social impact, sort of just a, which investors can't look at, but.
So do we measure the feel-good factor? Is that what
you're No, what I'm saying is the feel-good factor, you've obviously financially done it. Rational people, owners have done, bought baseball teams and have got into travel agencies, although neither of them on average would make a good investment. So all we say is now, gee, my values are actually, I'm not crazy about baseball, although I like baseball, but I'm crazy about having social impact. So if I substitute that, my returns are equal and it's a rational decision. When you get purely financial and get into somebody's only looking at the financial return, which, you know, the baker wouldn't do if he had his own money in, and that's why I think owner capitalism is very good, whereas a baker makes a better decision getting a $2 of flour wholesale plus $4 versus $5 for the cake. He has to take $5 a cake. I'll take the $6 every time. Mm-hmm. And so that's why there's a market, at least on the ownership side, I think, and that's why owners are important, foundations, if you can get to them, are important to actually make a difference on investing because they can look at the financial and the overall return. And unless they can resell that flour, they can't look at the overall return.
Mm, fantastic. So. And David, would you like to pick up the public policy question?
Yeah, before I do that, I just want to touch on one. John's got such great comments to make. Part of this is not whether I have a feel-good factor. Part of this is there's a real difference in the way, for example, Public Companies Act versus even some of the largest multi-billion-dollar family-owned entities act. Family-owned entities tend to think about creating assets of enduring, lasting value. And you can make the, and really this you've used it several times. I'm an owner versus I'm an investor. And I'd actually go one step further. I'm an owner versus an investor versus a trader.
Yeah,
all right?
Owners are not traders.
And owners are so far away from traders, and investors can go either way. All right? But the idea of owning, and that is, let me give you one of the things that bothered me most about my 10 years in venture capital.
It took 10 years to figure it out.
But, oh, it did. It did. It
did. Quick study.
Thank you. For the first 20 years of my career, I was on the entrepreneurial side. So we built things. You know, we built companies and people and things like that. And when I was a partner of the venture firm, I did a quick analysis after I was there about 3 or 4 years. So here's actually something even more damning. It wasn't that I took 10 years to learn it. I learned it in 3 years, and it took me 7 years to decide it. So I made this analysis that in the 20 years that we had invested as a venture capital partnership, and we had ended up in arguably the upper quartile of performance in our category, and yet we only had one surviving company. All right. So that meant we built a lot of things, sold a lot of things, a lot of things got transacted, we made a lot of money, they evaporated, and we have one company left. All right. So after 20 years, we have one company. And, you know, on one hand, did you make money for your investors? Great. All right. Did you actually create something of enduring value? And if that's where you're parked, then that wasn't a very satisfying experience. And so that's this issue of ownership is inextricably tied to this issue of social entrepreneurship or of creating enterprises that have a social and environmental and financial impact. Because I'd make the argument that if you delve into a lot of family enterprises, the mentality is we're here for a long, long time, and the only way we can be here for a long, long time is we've created a vibrant, sustainable enterprise, and presumably we've not polluted the moral commons. All right. To answer your question on public policy, and I will not delve into this issue of the public policy being dual-edged sword and unintended consequences. But for Americans, you know, there's an aspect of entrepreneurship that tends to want to be libertarian. So we have this mythology in entrepreneurship that, you know, that that entrepreneurs create from the whole, you know, from naked dirt, and we go out there and we just create, all right? And we forget that one of the greatest public domain assets was the internet, all right? And for the first 10, 15 years of the internet, there was no commerce on it. In fact, if you are old enough and you remember 1992, 93, 94, there was a huge battle between the homesteaders on the internet, which was all about the commons, all right, and it was all about a public domain and the greater good and the community asset versus, my God, Amazon's going to flog books on this public domain. But that was a public policy decision. We forget that electrification and rural electrification was public policy. We forget that the telecommunication acts were public policy. The highway was public policy. We forget that the home mortgage was public policy. So we forget that the creation of some of these largest markets that we get to take advantage of and play within were created as an artifact of public policy. And so I don't see these things at odds, you know, at all. In fact, we want to foster, you know, sort of enlighten public policy in these areas, all right? And if you ever have any doubt how powerful public policy can be, so in the U.S. right now, there's this massive debate and question about whether we'll in fact enact carbon policy or not. So if you ask the guys at Mid-America, which is the Berkshire Hathaway utility, right, they will tell you that in the last 24 months, in their geographic footprint, which is greatly Western United States, that ahead of the game, major corporate customers have been unplugging their power generation resources and replacing them with electric resources. So the largest users of electricity in Idaho have unplugged their coal fire and their natural gas fire kilns and replaced them with electric fire. Public policy, they're looking ahead and they're absolutely convinced that public policy is going to be, whether it's a tax, whether it's carbon, it doesn't matter. They know this is a bad thing from a public policy standpoint. They're getting out ahead of the game, and this isn't the nicest thing to do, but they're swapping their risk for the utility's risk, and the utility's feeling very, very vulnerable because they have no way of passing off that risk. All right? So public policy has a huge, huge impact on this sector in behavior and in changing actual economic behavior.
What an excellent point, because if you really want to scale, we were talking earlier in the session about private-public partnerships in the previous session. If you really want to scale, you need all the various constituents to work together.
Yep.
Let's take another few questions here, please. One over here, the lady in the red. Yes, thank you. And over there, please, the lady in beige.
Yes, my name is Linda Walker, and my company is Walker von Graf und Ried Asset Management in Switzerland. And I have a question or comment to make to Nick. I think, Nick, your idea is excellent, having a rating agency for social entrepreneurs. The only question that I have is, what about the conflict of interest? We saw this crisis that we have right now. One of the reasons for it is because all of this subprime debt was packaged and had a triple A rating, and then everybody from the pension funds in Germany to everywhere in the world bought this paper. And my question is, you know, the rating agencies, they do the ratings based on fees that they receive. How do you propose that you're going to have a system that's going to function, that's it's basically going to be an objective system and really give us the best results for the bottom line socially?
Okay, yeah, very good question. Let's hold there the lady in the...
My name's Chrysanthi Giotis. I'm from Social Enterprise Magazine. My question, again, is picking up something that Nick said earlier, which was that Nick separated out impact investing from mainstream investing. And am I the only person in this room who thinks that the holy grail is that all investing becomes impact investing? And if that is the holy grail, then how do we get there? And surely that's something about externalities and the proper pricing of externalities. And is there a role then for public policy, picking up David's point, in terms of making policy that says all investments at the end of the day have to have a balance sheet that says positive externalities?
Okay. Thank you very much. What is the holy grail? A question right there behind you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm James Perry from a traditional grant-making trust called Panapur, and we're just transitioning now into being more a sort of investment bank for social outcomes. And my question is, you're very sophisticated investors, and some of us are maybe less sophisticated. Is there a role for a social stock exchange?
Okay, terrific. So three very, very good questions. Hold it just a second, please. Three, so we don't forget what we promised to answer here. And Nick, would you kindly take the first one on the rating agencies?
I think that's an excellent question on rating agencies. I mean, obviously, there are a whole lot of different people who have been sort of take responsibility for the crisis that we had over the last two or three years, and a rating agency is certainly one of those. And so, therefore, it's a little bit difficult to sort of suggest what we need in this sector is an S&P or Moody's, when effectively S&P and Moody's, to a large extent, have become discredited. I think it's important to look at why they were discredited. I mean, I think it was an example of a very good idea that, at the margin, became a little bit distorted. Two principal issues. One was that they took on ratings of very complex instruments, which I think history shows they didn't really understand. And secondly, as you said, they introduced a conflict of interest by providing consulting services and at the same time providing a rating. You would hope that that would not happen. I think the risks are much less in a social rating agency. I think the big challenge of a social rating agency is, what's the revenue model? You know, who's going to pay for these social ratings? And at the moment, I commend particularly Rockefeller, who've been instrumental in providing funding for the development of a social rating agency, but it is going to be tough in the long term. I think it's critical to making social impact investing easy to understand and investable for the non-sophisticated audience. But the revenue model in the long term is going to be a challenging one. Can I just quickly answer the other question too? I made the point that I think when you're investing in when I think about impact investing, I'm thinking about providing new capital to companies. So therefore, I'm not thinking about buying and selling of shares on the stock exchange. I don't think that's not the same thing as saying that I don't think that socially responsible investing by every public and private company in the world is important, that it's something that should be encouraged through as much as possible through public policy. I mean, I meet with sort of major institutional investors, particularly equity investors, all the time. And I've really been encouraged recently over the last year or 18 months how they're really, and it really has to come, that push for socially responsible investing has to come really from the shareholders. And I am very encouraged as I go around and meet the largest sort of mutual fund complexes and so on in the world, how seriously they are now beginning to take their responsibilities in terms of making sure that the companies they invest in have sound environmental policies, good governance, good social policies for workforce and so on. So I think that's a social response. I don't mean to suggest that it isn't important. It's critically important, but I think it's a slightly different area.
Let's expand that, because that was such an excellent question. What is the Holy Grail, really? Is it the idea that impact in that this notion of financial return, but also quantifiable social and environmental benefits, that really permeates the DNA of every investment philosophy, if you will. Shall we open that up, John? Any comments, David? Any other thoughts from you?
I guess I go back to my sort of simple beliefs, which is that, you know, it depends if you like the cake. So if the owners, as a group, there's two ways. You can own it as a group, you can own it individually, or you can own it through a third party. I think Nick's example basically is you're owning through a third party, which is investment managers, who manages other people's business. So if you get 10 different people, then the investment manager is forced to find the only common denominator, and voila, the only common denominator is financial return. If, however, we had those 10 investors, which three were on anti-smoking campaigns, three were going to give money towards renewable energy, and four were going to give money to helping elderly people, and potentially through a pension fund, whatever, then if you had social enterprise to invest in those three areas, then for them it would be a different answer and be easier to do. So I think that's one thing to look at. So it depends on the owner. So all they're doing is simplifying. I think that if you're owned through an investment manager, we haven't found a way that he can find a common ground among all those different investors, so he chooses that one. Whereas if we disaggregate the investment to the 10 investors, we probably would get more social investing. So I guess the answer everybody'd like is yes, but we have to find a way to do that. And maybe, you know, public investing in some ways at least is more limited in that area. And I think the second indirect point was on externalities, and we talked about positive externalities. I think that, you know, there's, if you look at how one thing that's very important, one of the reasons that a lot of major things are happening is that we have to look back to the whole as a business person, look back to the accounting. And if you look at the accounting, what do we account for as negative externalities? And if accountants go back to their basic principle of conservatism and going concern principle, if you're mid-America and if I'm the accountant there, and I say, gee, your volumes are going up, you know, that's great, you know, because, and then you realize they're going up from people taking away your things, and you realize there's going to be a coal price. Okay, so what do you do on that? And you say, gee, there's some health issues there. The accountants are going to more and more, I think, have to look into wider issues and have to put just by their basic principles going concern. So you can't be a going financial concern if you have this adjacent liability. So I think as those negative externalities are identified to investors, then, you know, the cost of capital for coal companies will go up, which is a good thing. So that maybe it's not impact investing, but it's indirect impact investing. So I think better accounting for negative externalities could be really important in at least identifying what the whole world is. Because, you know, I think everybody's agreed, and we had a session, I guess, 2 days ago, where, you know, saying that some companies have realized, I think it was a gentleman from Canada mentioning, some companies have realized they're part of the world now. And I think if that realization becomes true, therefore we have to take that part of their world is they're affecting the world, and they're affecting the world negatively. Therefore, we have to put on their statements. Because those negative carbon things for mid-America would be much greater than any increase in revenue, and which would give an investor a false concern, as your point, I think, a false concern about whether the company's viable or not. Because it's, you know, it's almost like a drug where you know it's killing people, but eventually they'll find out. And if the accountants knew that, they would put that in your statements.
And I think we're touching on something so fundamental here, because we talked earlier about, you know, historically having thought in silos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, okay, philanthropy is here, business is here, never the twain shall meet. Are we running the risk now, unless we are actually taking the question that was raised earlier seriously, are we running the risk that we are going to start thinking in new silos where we have the real business, we have impact investing, and we have philanthropy? So all we have done is really just create a new silo. Or do we really need to start thinking in terms of this is a fundamental philosophy that just needs to be properly integrated?
So I may be way too optimistic, because I tend to believe that folks are, you know, reasonably rational and will behave rationally, which isn't always the case. So to that point, if you look at the term ESG, environmental, social, and governance, one of the interesting things that we've seen is, as a result of Sarbanes-Oxley, the issue of governance, whether it's done properly or not, but there's no longer a rational investment analyst that wouldn't consider governance as a core aspect of looking at the risk management of this investment, and therefore both the risk side as well as the value side. All right. I'd make the argument that increasingly the smarter companies are internally starting to value the externality risks. And this isn't very, it's no conceptual extrapolation. You know, we're involved with a company that is heavily dependent on cotton, and they're absolutely convinced it's a Fortune 100 company, and they're absolutely convinced that within a foreseeable time frame, water at its basis, 1,800 gallons of water to get into a pound of cotton, that this, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out this cannot be a good thing. Therefore, it's a fundamental threat to the company, and it's a fundamental threat to their viability. We think that at some point, just like the cost accounting discipline is about managerial accounting versus financial accounting, that externality will become an extension of financial, of managerial accounting. Because as a manager, I need to have a way of looking at the business from a risk standpoint and an actual imputed cost standpoint. I may not be hit with 1,800 gallons of water for every pound of cotton today, but I know I'm going to be. Now the risk is how many years, but I'm almost positive I'm going to be. And so this issue of environmental pricing being factored into business, and therefore, again, I'll get back to the smart financial analyst who's looking at these markets, transactions, or companies, we're already watching the E part of ESG. The G's gone. The E part is starting to be gone in the sense that it's going mainstream. All right, you can't look at a power company. I mean, let's be rational. I have a power company that's 99% weighted coal, and I have a power company that's 35% weighted wind. You're an investor. You're looking. You're not a trader, so you're not trading on the next 12 months or the next 4 months or, heaven forbid, the next 2 days. You're trying to hold this asset for 5 years. Which one do you want to hold? All right. So now the E part goes. So now the S part, and this gets into, can we now economically impute S, and I think that's still a bit of a challenge. But we know that the whole issue of, for example, workforce and child labor, those are very visible elements of S that have already been imputed. And again, they're imputed as risk. All right. So if I have a work stoppage, if I have a legal issue, if I have a regulatory issue that puts me out, so I'd make the argument that in some ways, The greatest victory and the holy grail will be that the E, the S, and the G and various aspects of it get embedded into almost every asset class and almost every asset. And I think we see the rudiments of that taking place already.
David, thank you so much. Unfortunately, the time has flown. We have time for really two more questions. And I acknowledge you. Yes, here, there's one. And then one more, please, and over here, please. So those two, and unfortunately, I'm sorry. No, I promised I would come to you as well. So sorry, three more. One mic over here, please. Short, sharp, please.
Thanks very much. Quick question along the same lines of the theme of integrated, holistic, triple bottom line investment, and the need to have. To unlock or unleash the power of social capital markets. Has there been any thought along the lines of structuring a grants convertible to equity market, having contracts which can then be traded, future contracts, but also converted by owners themselves? So grants convertible to equity.
Thank you so much for that question. I just remembered there was the question about the stock exchange, the need for a social stock exchange. We did not answer that. So if you can help me, we answer that question. Okay, very good. Over here, please, Tom.
My name is Tom Hazlett, and my question is to you, Nick. This builds on the question earlier asked about sources of funds. You represent a very large bank, which has done, from my perspective, great work in pioneering into the space, and your discussion today illuminates that. The question I have is that given the availability or access to private high net wealth capital through your private banking businesses, given the opportunities to get insights into the commodity chain, value chains, through the research and investment into companies that are operating in the space, where, as an example with JP Morgan, is a big institution in bringing these themes together to create a business unit that is going to, I hate to use the word, exploit these opportunities, these growing demands from analysts in your research department for insight, and potentially from your high net worth clients who are also seeking more and more of this. When do you, as an example of the big institutions, stick the neck out and take reputational risk?
Very good question. And the last question here, please.
Thank you. And very, very short. First of all, I think I agree with David that he might be too optimistic in his concern. We made a service in the Bellagio Forum some few years ago about how do foundations actually manage the money, and the vast majority says, we take care of the 5% of the distribute, the rest we leave to the professionals, and the professionals have no clue how to do it in our way. So you have a big opportunity, and we all to really pressure it. A very specific question and advice which you might give to the social entrepreneurs, given that you have not the objective of capital maximization, but wealth preservation over time and keep a longer time horizon. Would it make sense to suggest to social entrepreneurs, when they ask for money, rather ask for bond-like structures, which give a little dividend a long time, which you can accept at a much lower interest rate than having the venture capital, private equity, and myself venture capital, that you need to something which increases value within a sensible amount of time and has an exit?
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take those two questions together, please, on the social stock exchange and the social impact bond, or whatever you want to call it. Any volunteers? Nick, would you like to take it?
Which question do you want?
On the social stock exchange. Should we have a social stock exchange?
I think that's a good question. I don't have a good answer for it. Stock exchange, the value of a stock exchange is that it brings together buyers and sellers. So clearly we know there's a lot of social enterprises that would be interested in an easy way, a sort of a relatively lightly regulated way of accessing capital. I'm not sure whether on the investor side, whether that would necessarily catalyze huge amounts of additional investment into the space. But again, I don't think we've really spent enough time. I know the idea has been kicked around, but I've never really seen any rigorous sort of analysis on whether that might work. But it's an interesting idea.
On the question of whether, two questions, I guess. One is that on the question that I think was well put, that we've gone through governance, we've gone through the environment, and David's point about we're hitting social, and the other big social one we're starting to hit, of course, is food companies and obesity and leading to type 2 diabetes. And there's one where we can just do the graph in a certain large North American country and others, which will show an enormous healthcare bubble, which is almost should be put as a star and an asterisk on the U.S. government budget. So I think that's another social one. And I think on Jan Ehrlich's point about foundations are looking for. That's a real challenge because we're a first generation and a foundation. So a lot of my team, we sold our business by parts. So the top level team was there. So we all came over. We can do things. We're active entrepreneurs, owners. There are other foundations which are many generations away, which are professionally managed, and maybe they're not the best people to be actually active entrepreneur owners. But one of the investments we've always thought they'd look at would be what I call a preferred share, which is basically has the sort of more fixed return and certain return of a bond, but doesn't have the demand for bankruptcy of a bond. So I think that there's something what I would love to have, and we'd love to have had it in our business for Buchanan, as sort of a social preferred share, which has a minimum 7, but hopefully 10, 15-year time horizon, has some flexibility around that, has a certain return plus a bonus return if the real thing happens to be a home run, because you don't want to take that away. And then also quantifies very clearly what the other goals are. So if the foundation's goal was to reduce CO2 in coal plants, then as part of their investment program, they could show them that by taking this bond at, let's say, 6% plus 0 to 4%, depending on the return, and that return could come at the end. So don't have the 10% demanded every year, because if you have to have it at the end, and maybe you can accumulate for a little while, because you don't want the person to take any money out of developing the business. So it has to be at the end. You can't totally back-end it. You have to probably over time pay some dividend, but at the beginning maybe none, and then it accumulates. And then have that bonus at the end, and that would allow for you not to have to sell. So I think it's very important. So they'd like that, and then they get a good accounting of what your view is on their goal. Their goal was to reduce CO2. You'd show that your biomass plant over time, for example, reduced this much coal, and you view that initially it would have been nobody who had done it, and after 3 years, another company came in, they wouldn't have come in without you, so we rallied that at 50%, and I think those numbers could be quite impressive. So I think that, and also, it's tough for a foundation to find something at 6% with a little bonus for 15 years. Now, of course, there's risk it doesn't work, I understand that, but still, and as long as the equity holders and the people in it are behind you and clearly will lose everything, then I think there's a good chance that'd be a great investment. I'd hope that other foundations who can invest socially would do a social preferred bond. Thank you so much.
We are not doing a number of your questions justice, and I'm very aware that we are standing between you and the cake. So I think we do need to wrap up, and I just want to give each of the panelists an opportunity, 30 seconds, short, sharp point that you would like to leave the audience with. Nick, can we start with you?
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly, as a final thought, I mean, I think there's good news and bad news in this whole area. I mean, the good news is that I think a huge amount of, if I look to when I first got involved in this area a couple of years ago, I think there's been a huge amount of progress over the last couple of years in terms of the energy and enthusiasm and the momentum, the quality of people coming into the field, I think, has improved dramatically. So I think that's all very positive. I think the bad news is there's an enormous amount of work to do, and I think in all your questions you highlight a lot of those areas. I mean, we haven't made it easy enough for people to invest in this broadly defined asset class yet, and that's rating, whether that's rating agencies or social stock exchanges or indexes or research. So I think there's an enormous amount of work to be done to really build this as a real asset class. But I think this, again, I've said in forums like this before, I think this will be one of the great, most powerful investment movements over the next decade or so. Mm-hmm. And it's great to be part of it.
Fantastic.
Just three quick points, I think, is that I think that social enterprise can, in some cases, do much better than a donation can. And in those examples, that should be promoted because of more efficient allocation of capital. A quick example from the head of Swed Fund in Sweden said that for every dollar of equity put in a business and we make a net return on it, we get $3 of taxes from that company we're investing in the local country, which the government theoretically put to social service or elsewhere. So then versus a donation, which at best you'll get $1 worth of value given the same purpose, okay, so assuming the government had the same purpose. So that was interesting. So I think that, and also, you know, one of the issues of, we haven't heard social enterprise being hit by the criticism which foundations are, which is it's not sustainable. So, you know, that's going ahead. The second point was that I think to answer a bit Nick's question, we have to look at the full return, and the full return depends on how you value things. And so, therefore, the baseball owner, therefore, do you like the cake? So if you like the baseball owner, you like to go to the baseball games, you like having this benefit, you should value that. Either economically because it's a substitute for a donation, so I think we can do it better through Buchanan Substitute Coal than we can European Climate Foundation to stop new plants. So I think we have to take that into account. But secondly, even on the financial returns, if we're new to the area, you tend to have better financial returns. And if people have good values, hopefully they'll be good people and they'll work hard and they'll have other motivations as money, and hence they'll maybe work hard and get a better return. So there's not a statistical average everywhere. And I think lastly, we have to find a way to get the disintermediaries in the finance area to be able to look at these things. And I think that David, to his credit, had a very good idea. They're starting to, by looking at the issues that could be potentially negative. Yes. The coal plant example, and any analyst now will write about those issues. I think the social ones we talked about are good. And then, you know, potentially even having accountants put it in their statements so we can help, at least on the negative side, and hence maybe positive direct investment to more socially responsible enterprises.
Fantastic. Thank you, David.
Maybe just three quick thoughts. One is that when we use the word innovation, we typically think of it in terms of invention, in terms of technology, and I think that the last hour and a half, hopefully one of the things that you've embraced is that financial innovation is going to be one of the sources of change here in this field, and truly that finance is a form of innovation. The second thing is a huge value can be created in the structuring of these instruments. A lot of the discussions have been about how you take lessons learned in this first generation and actually now create structure. Because if you can't create structure, you can't scale, and you can't get to retail. You can't make it easy. And so these three words to me really drive me, and that's the opportunity for innovation, the opportunity to structure what is ad hoc into something that's repeatable. And if you can do that, you've created a huge opportunity to scale.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you so much, each of you. David, thank you
You know, I think that saying, okay, governments and aware, and you don't believe it until you go through them. Governance is now not an issue, right? You know, it's in your reports. These coal plants are not an issue. And this whole sugar thing, I mean, you do the numbers behind any Purdean foundation who does health care. We'll say there's this bomb coming along in the United States, which is crazy. And if we don't do something about that,